Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Our latest compilation show is entirely free. You'll hear a couple of ads, but the money that we make from those barely covers our costs at the big interview. I want to personally invite you to become a socio, a member, to support the big interview and make sure it continues. Sign up at patreon.com/GrahamHunter for £2.99 and you'll get an extra big interview every month plus a documentary special. Sign up now and you'll unlock for yourself the entire archive of socio interviews dating back to Rafa van der Vaart last August. If you've been thinking about joining, now is the time. It's you, the socios, who subscribe that keep us on the road. For the price of a pint, you'll get hours and hours of ad-free content every month, and you'll keep us going. Sign up at patreon.com/GrahamHunter, and we'll all be very grateful. Thank you. Today's Father's Day. Well, on the big interview at least. Our latest compilation show is dedicated to the men who mean the most to many of our guests from season two. The men who offered them advice, even when it wasn't wanted, who kept them on the straight and narrow, and who deservedly shared in their football successes. We begin with Mark Noble. The West Ham captain phones his dad every morning on the way to training just to talk soccer. It's during these chats that Mark is often reminded how lucky he is to play for the team he supported when he was a kid. His dad certainly helped him along the way to that career at West Ham, with Mark revealing that his old man once installed a secret gate at the bottom of their garden just so that his boy had easy access to a school playing field behind the house. Johnny Evans and Peter Crouch also grew up with strong parental guidance, with Peter's dad going the extra mile by introducing his son to the Curver method, while Steve McManaman revels in cherished childhood memories of going to matches with his dad. Chris Sutton and Alex McLeish recall that their fathers each favoured the tough love approach, but both men acknowledged the positive impact that had on their football development. And bouncing Benny McCarthy, a happy-go-lucky man, somebody who represents joy in football and who made us laugh so much in his big interview, but he admits that he might have joined one of those deadly gangs he grew up around in Cape Town, South Africa, had it not been for the fear of what his dad would do to him if he did. But then we leave it to Maka to have the final word in this clip show as he explains how he ran to celebrate in front of his old man after scoring a great goal in the Champions League final. Enjoy.
I ring my dad every day on the way to training, 9:30 or 9 o'clock. We have a 10-minute chat. I normally ring him on the way home as well, see what he's been up to and stuff. And we talk about football and... The last, obviously, he said, Mark, he said to me about a year ago, he said, Mark, do you wake up every morning, look at the scene and think, fucking, I'm a lucky bastard. And I went, well, how do you mean that? He went, because you used to walk in from school with a West Ham backpack and a West Ham folder with my work in that I got Jeff Hurst to sign outside the stadium once, you know? Brilliant. Obviously, we used to walk to the games and from my house. And he said, you've just probably captained West Ham through two of the most historical seasons in the club's history, leaving Upton Park and having what our generation of fans are saying is the best team and year we've ever had through excitement and everything, and then leading them into this new stadium, which is going to be there way past... all of us, do you know what I mean? And I never really thought of it like that, and I just, and he said, for a local boy that grew up supporting West Ham to be able to wear the armband and lead your team out at them games. Don't forget, you could have got injured and missed them games, as everyone gets injured. You could have missed leading the team out. You could have missed, got suspended, but you was there and you led that team into out of the old stadium into the new. And he said, like, no one will ever take that away from you. We lived in a house in a place called Jenkins Road. And behind us was a university or something, like a field.
Mm.
So what my dad done was, he got a geezer around from work, and our back garden, we had a fence, and then behind our fence was like the strong iron railings with the spikes on top, so you couldn't get over there.
Yeah.
So obviously, at first, I used to get on top of our shed, do you know what I mean, or put a lump of wood and jump over and constantly hurt ourselves. So he had the fella come round, and the fella cut a little gate at the bottom of our fence, put a couple of hinges on it, and then undone the screws in the metal fence so we could get through our gate, slide the gates for, and get through and play footy.
Private gate in the fence.
So I used to be out there till, like, my mum used to shout, "Mark!" And it was dark at the time, you know what I mean? So he didn't answer back, so he didn't want to go in. And we used to play out there for hours and hours. And when they used to cut the grass, we used to make little five-side pitches out of the dead grass, you know, with the goals.
Brilliant.
Pucker it was.
Getting out, playing football with all the other kids in the street, you know, street football, and you know, definitely brings back good memories, and I value that sometimes more than, you know, at other stages in my life where I'd be alone kicking the ball against the wall, being able to go out and have fun.
You Corey knew that there was an outside world, not just that, you know, your dad had gone to Chelsea and at Arsenal and he said you're better, but I think some people grow up maybe in a bubble, you know, a very happy bubble, but they're not aware that there's another big world or that professional football might come to them. And I don't know the answer to this question, but at a very young age, I think, somebody comes tapping you on the shoulder or says to your dad, "But this lad are coming to United." What was that process like?
I mean, it was strange. I mean, I don't think you grasp it at that age. Mm. You don't. Even when I look back now, I don't think, you know, at that time I knew I was going to be a footballer. Or I remember at that time, you know, you always have self-doubt, you know, like, mm-hmm. you're still so far away. And my mum and dad, I think with my dad's experience of going across the water and coming back, you know, they made us realise that, you know, like, you've got so far to go. Don't think for a second that, you know, you've made it as a footballer. But, I mean, I can remember the game. I think we played a cup final. We were playing a game in Lisburn, and my dad came to me after the game and he said the Man United scout was here. I was 9 years old at the time, and he wants you to come to the School of Excellence.
Wow.
So it was just a local, you know, Northern Ireland School of Excellence which had set up. And it wasn't long after, maybe 6 months, where the scouts were over from the chief scout at the time, I think it was Jeff Watson, to come over and watch the game. And he was like, "Right, they want you to go across on trial." So I went across. It was the 31st of October, I remember, because it was my dad's birthday, Halloween night. And taking off in Belfast, I remember seeing all the fireworks. We have fireworks in Belfast on Halloween night. And I remember going across, and there was probably about six or seven lads at the time, and that was the start of it. That was me going across, and quite regularly at that time. They changed the rules later on, maybe when I was about 12 or 13, which made it a lot more difficult for lads, you know, with it, that were living with, outside an hour and a half travelling mm-hmm. distance of, mm-hmm. of Manchester. So, yeah, my road with Man United at that time was started very early in my life, really.
And at what point does, I'd imagine Sir Alex Ferguson and your dad would have pretty similar experiences and views on life. And I know through Alec and Martin Ferguson that their father spent some time playing in Ireland, working in Belfast as well. I'd have thought that they would have had quite similar views about upbringing, about football.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it hurt my dad, the fact that he didn't. He never sort of came across like that in that way. But, you know, it was all about, you know, hard work. And I think he thought, well, his two sons have got a chance. Because he gave us that chance by encouraging us. I know that, you know, we weren't just born and said, right, we're going to be, because we were his sons and we had a bit of football ability. You know, he took us out, he played football with us, and he encourages us to always go out and practice and work on our skill, basically, work on our technique. And, you know, those early days, he says, as the most you can learn at a younger age, you know, the better it'll stand you going forward. And that was something that, you know, even now I still think I wish I'd done more.
Really?
Yeah, because there's certain things that, you know, maybe you think, right, I'm not good at that, I wish I'd done that better. And, you know, the earlier in your life, I think that you practice those things. And
you think they stick with you?
I think they stick with you, and I think obviously you gain confidence from being good at something, so you're able to work on it even better.
You mentioned something that really interests me, that, and I hope it's not repetitive in this theme of interviews, but that idea about needing somebody to give you confidence, to show you a path, to encourage you. For example, a couple of interviews ago, Peter Crouch was talking about his dad engaging one of the Curver coaches and actually taking his boy, Peter, to practice in a local park before school. I mean, these days, how many dads do that? I mean, I think a lot of kids who should be coming to football possibly now come from homes where either both parents are working every damn hour and you never see them, or broken homes. And maybe kids who don't have that figure to encourage, to guide, just to show you that it's worthwhile playing. People, at the moment, we make a big deal of handheld games and videos, and kids are being lost to football. Yeah. But parents are a big influence, to parents and teachers, no?
Well, it's true. I think, I mean, my dad worked long hours. I think when I was a kid, he was working in the shipyard in Belfast, obviously. So I think the benefit I had is, like I said, I grew up on a working class estate where there was loads of kids out playing football. So it was never it never felt like we were being forced out the door and not the playing video games. In fact, I don't even think we had them then.
No.
I maybe had it like
no.
The only option was to go out and play football, and there was lots of lads on our street, and like I say, we had the football pitches behind the house, so we were always out playing.
Who's the kid that had the ball? Did you have the ball?
No, I never had the ball.
Because the kid who had the ball, if you lived in a neighbourhood where the kid who had the ball was good, you were screwed. Because not only could he walk off, but he could probably beat as well. But it always seemed to be, whenever you're growing up, the kid who wasn't very good, it was the one who had the ball. And if his team lost, off he went home with the football.
No, there was actually quite a... I think me and Corey were almost probably the youngest two lads in the street. So we were always around older lads who were playing. And actually, it made us maybe grow up in a way. Yeah. We had to sort of play against these lads and, you know, get stuck in. That's what you had to do.
Did you think about that? I mean, they're in days at 6, 7, 8, 9 where you knocked over, you lose a bit of skin. Maybe one of them says, don't do that to me again.
I can remember one day, actually, I'm out playing, and this guy, he's a bit of the estate bully. He started, I don't know, maybe I was showing off, or maybe he thought, oh, I'll teach him a lesson. But he just started, you know, every time I got the ball, kicking my legs and booting my shins. And I came into the house after, and I had all these cuts on my legs. And my mum was obviously getting all upset. And my dad said, well, first of all, he told me, the next time, pick up a stick and hit him with it.
Quite right, too.
And then he said, well, you know, one day whenever you're playing for Man United and he's looking tickets, you don't get him tickets. And, you know, that was, I mean, obviously he was probably thinking, no, I'm never going to play for Man United. That was just a pipe dream, really. But, you know, those little things like that stuck with me, and I always wanted to have that ambition maybe to prove people wrong as well.
So this Curver method, I mean, how'd you end up? Whose idea is this?
In all honesty, it was probably my dad. My dad's a big, huge influence on my career.
Chelsea man?
Yeah, he is, yeah. I mean, I'm Peter after Peter Osgood, believe it or not. I mean, he was a big Chelsea fan.
And is there a rabbit story?
Yeah, I had a rabbit called Kerry Dixon back in the day, yeah. He's another, obviously, hero when I was growing up. But, yeah, I mean, he's a big influence on my career, and I think he... obviously he wanted me to enjoy it, but he wanted me to be as good as I could be. And I think, you know, we used to go out and play football before school. And obviously I used to play with my mates as well. But he was a big fan of Corver. Obviously he's a student of the game, my dad. He loves it. I mean, he can tell you, you know, stories right through the 70s, 80s, 90s. So he found out about Corver and just thought, you know, we'll give it a try for me as a kid, and I loved it and just wanted to keep going back, and I just felt it really helped me, you know, later on in my career, technique wise, I think.
Well, let's do some relic, because Cruyff might have been part of the Corver method. Of course, name might have been used.
Definitely used, yeah.
For what he's most famous for, I presume, of course. The turn against Sweden in the 74 World Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
But like you said, so what I like a great deal, and what we've talked about hugely across this podcast, is skills development, technique. My desperation, even as a Scot, to see repeated England teams who I could tolerate winning a trophy every 50 or 60 years, lacking the technique to control a game and the passes or first-time touch all the time, every player. And therefore, it really excites me that your dad said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give Peter the best chance to enjoy his career, to have a professional career, and that his skills will be predominant. And that, I mean, that's why I turn on the TV to watch you. But the Cruyff moment, as you said, you can relate it directly to something that happens in your career, because what you're learning on a muddy field in, I don't know, Ealing, Austerlee, I can't remember. And also with West Mid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, West Middlesex Colts, yeah.
You bring that into play when, for example, in a famous hat-trick at Anfield.
Yeah, exactly right, yeah. I mean, it's one of my favourite goals, probably just, I mean, everything to do with it, really. Obviously, the fixture being Liverpool-Arsenal, Kop End, obviously, in my... You know, it was the third goal from a hat trick, and obviously, and the technique as well. So I think, all those things. I mean, you know, listen, the way I play now is obviously wholeheartedly now, and of course, I've got to be good in the air. I'm 6'7", so I've had to probably work on that. But I think the hardest part of the game is controlling the ball and being able to be comfortable in possession and stuff like that. And I think that obviously comes from the grounding that I had. In to do with at the core of with my dad receiving the ball, we used to go out with 10 balls in the park, and he used to ping balls from everywhere at me, and I used to get it down and do it in two touch, and it was just repetitiveness, really. And I think that certainly helped me, and of course I had to adapt my game and become probably more aggressive, better in the air than I actually was technique wise. I had to work on that, but all the other sides of the games, like the volleying and the receiving of the ball, I think came early because of sheer practice and enjoyment in that practice.
So in the moment when that ball's coming into you for the third of the hat-trick, I guess, and it's coming in from the right, you're doing something that you've continued to practice, I guess, in training for years afterwards. But what is it about, because in my mind I'm all relating this to people saying for England's great problem is they can't win at penalties.
Yeah.
People say, well, it's not worth practicing because pressure, whatever. Whereas there is something in that muscle memory, if you do it repeatedly, there's a far better chance that you'll pull off a Cruyff turn, or you'll send Colaturi the wrong way, or you'll finish well once you've turned, or you'll score a penalty. You're a believer in muscle memory and repetitive.
Yeah, certainly. I always remember being with England and Frank Lampard and David Beckham, obviously two fantastic players. And I always remember Beckham used to do five, six, seven free kicks after training every single day. And Frank Lampard used to do five, six, seven penalties every day against the keeper, David James or Paul Robson, whoever it was. And, you see that there's Beckham so good at free kicks for a reason, and Frank Lampard's so clinical at penalties for a reason. And that's just simply because I think if you repeat doing the same skill over and over, I think you're more confident in the situation when it comes into a game. And, Beckham, the free kick against Greece, something like that. I just feel like, you've done it so many times, you can do it, you're more confident at executing that skill. And you can't replicate the crowd, but you can replicate the skill. And I think if you know you can do it, you're more confident at doing it, then it's so important to practice it. And I think anyone who says there's no point in practicing, you can't replicate it, is talking nonsense.
All right. Thank you. And we came all this way just to hear that phrase. Tell the world. I don't mean to send a stupid question, but in the instant that you pull off something like you did against Arsenal, or of the many, many clever, technically superb goals that you've scored, are you thinking, or can you remember in instances like that, whether it's that hat-trick goal or not, when the ball's coming at you, to what degree does your brain kick in and say, at really high speed, I'm going to do this, this and this? Or is it literally just predatorial instinct? You're doing it without thinking?
The Arsenal goal, there have been goals, different goals, I think. But the Arsenal goal was probably, I was full of confidence. Obviously, I'd scored two already. And, I couldn't really. I think it was probably instinct, that goal. But there's other goals, like the one I scored for Stoke, against Man City, the volley.
Yeah.
That I'd actually tried that a week previous. And, I'd actually do it I don't do that in training a lot, but I try it in training a lot, and where it's sort of like it's something that I've thought about previously. I know that I'm actually better at volleying than I am, shooting 30 yards off the ground. So I know that when the ball drops, I know that I want to get it up so I can have more of a chance of volleying it, because I know that my technique at volleying is probably better than it is off the floor.
Gosh.
So, which is... It's just I've always loved volleying. I've always done it as a kid, and it's something that I've always been okay at. So that is obviously something that is not, it's instinctive, because
more conscious.
A bit more conscious, because I know that, I want to get the ball up to volley it, and I remember trying it against Blackburn, and actually about 2 weeks before that goal, and the keeper saving it. But it was, it probably gave me more confidence to try it again, and thankfully it did, and it was one of the best I've scored.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just out of curiosity, when you're growing up and you're an Everton fan, these moments you're referring to when Souness, Phil Thoms, Lifty's cuts, were they, in your neighbourhood, your family, were they dark moments?
They would have been, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, just conceptually.
Yeah, of course they would.
Because at that stage, you're not Steve McManaman,
no,
you're a European Cup winner, you're a fan.
Steve McManaman, Everton fan, yeah. Yeah, I was at that very famous game where Glenn Keely got sent off for Everton and Rushy scored 4 and Liverpool won 5 at Goodison Park. And I was sitting, bereft as an Everton supporter in the Gladys Street as my junior Evertonian, thinking, what's just gone on there? You know that you're going to go to school on the Monday and you're just going to get taunted or whatever. That's just what it was. And thankfully, I went through that age of 84, 85, 86, Peter Reid and Bracewells, and Everton won the league and Everton won cups and the European Cup Winners' Cup. Thankfully, I was a teenager going to watch that great Everton team with Sheedy and Trevor Stephen and Sharpie and Andy Gray, and it was like I was one of the lucky few to really appreciate that as a 12, 13, 14-year-old, thinking, how lucky am I? I'm watching Everton. 84, when Sharpie and Andy Gray beat Watford in the FA Cup final, I went with my dad. I'm a 12-year-old, that was...
At Wembley.
Go to Wembley and watch your team win. Things don't get better, do they? As a 12-year-old, they don't get better. And then, of course, I was there everybody's year then watching Everton and Liverpool and then actually playing there myself. So I was lucky, but as a 12-year-old, queuing up for your Wembley tickets and having it and getting on a bus with your father and singing songs.
Bus down with your dad. These are...
Greatest time of my life. Singing songs with my dad and all the men and... Of course, they're having a few beers on the way and talking about football.
It's not illegal.
And effing and blind and stuff. And you just think, this is how amazing is this? I mean, I had all that anyway because I'd watch my dad play football. He played locally in Liverpool. He was good, my dad. He was a very good player, amateur level.
Positionally, yeah. What did he do?
I think initially he was very skillful, but everybody always said, you still get it now. You're a good player, but you're never as good as your father. In Liverpool, he had a good reputation, my dad. So I was always, at a very young age, of course, I was a huge football fan, but... from when I could walk, I'd be watching my father play football and I'd be in the pubs with him and sitting there and, on a Saturday waiting for the local, used to be called the Pink Echo in Liverpool. A paper used to come out about 5 o'clock with all the football results and stuff. And I always remember he'd play in the afternoon and we'd go back to the pub and sit there with this Pink Echo looking at all the results and sitting, listening to my father and all his mates talk about these stories. And it was just incredible times.
Was it a rich, witty, colourful environment?
Very colourful environment, but again...
working class Liverpool, it just, you know, it was just amazing. I just loved being with my father and all his mates and listen to all their stories. And, you know, you just, you felt part of it. Even as an 8-year-old, you felt part of, you know, you were like being a man sitting there.
I guess it brings you on. It probably gives you aspirations too. I want to be like them. Mm-hmm. I want to do this. I want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And if you see him and he can play, I suppose you begin to model yourself on how you use the ball, what teammates mean to you, sense
what camaraderie,
unity.
Of course, definitely.
You used a phrase that you didn't enjoy the rejection at Norwich, but you had this repertoire, this second chance. Was that mostly to do with you or the club or your dad?
All things. I was playing, taking my GCSEs, and I had two elder sisters and an elder brother, and they all went on and took A-levels, and I was a bit of a black sheep in the family in terms of I wasn't a great tryer at school. I was told... in uncertain terms that, you know, I you know, wasn't trying hard enough, and the best thing for me to do would be to go out and get a job. And this all coincided in a very short space of time. I actually went for a job as a clerk of Norfolk County Council.
God.
So where I could have ended up.
Oh, my God. There is indeed a God. Well done.
There you go, And this was a multiple choice exam in
would you like A, English League Division 1, or B, push pens and paper clips?
You know, I can't yet. Well, I don't think you're far off. But anyway, somehow I got the job. But in this space of time, what had happened is I was playing for my school in a county cup competition, and I did quite well. Our school team got through to the semi-finals, and there was a local coach who was affiliated with Norwich City, a fellow called Graham Wren, and he came to watch me. I scored a hat-trick in the semi-final. I think that was against Caister, which is near Yarmouth. In the final we played Yarmouth, and I scored a hat-trick in the final, and then they asked me down for another trial. Norwich did, and I didn't. This was at the end of the season, so it was a very brief trial. And the manager, Dave Stringer, who was the first team manager at the time, had come to watch me subsequently a couple of months earlier. Not specifically me, but a group of lads playing at Yarmouth. And again, at that stage, he, you know, thought I wasn't good enough. So they, essentially what happened at the end of the season, within a brief spell, they took a massive chance on me to give me a YTS youth training scheme, £29.50 the first year, £35 the second year. And in those years since I had been rejected, which I'd be 13, 14, 15, 16, my dad, who was, you know, definitely by far the biggest influence on me, in terms of fitness and pushing me, he was very, I wouldn't use the word brutal, but he would, you know, give me a kick up the backside. He was my school teacher. Mm-hmm. He was very hard on me.
It's a dynamic.
If I got praise, it was quite rare. I mean, I remember refereeing a school game once, and I went down injured, and he would never give me any favours. Never do me any favours. And I think that was part of him being a teacher in front of the other boys as well. You know, even that when I was doing well, and you know, I was, you know, one of the best players in the team. Without being big-headed, but I was. But he wouldn't give me praise in front of anybody. And if I went down injured, he'd tell me to get up. But in terms of fitness, and you know, you've seen me play. Never the quickest at all. You know, I was never the fastest at school. I was never the most athletic. You know, far from it. But in terms of those years, the grounding which he gave me in fitness, I think, set me up and was possibly the biggest part of why I got on, I think, and made it. And then also, once I'd got in there at 16, 17, the boys who had made the steps and signed schoolboy forms, 13, 14, 15, who had an affiliation with the club, I can say this, but I felt psychologically that they expected it to be a natural progression. That's what I felt.
And I felt when I went down there that I was psychologically, it's easy to say I wanted it more than them, but I was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that to pass me by that opportunity again.
Where does the drive come to be competitive all the time, no matter how good you are? You're a very good footballer, clever in your trade, but winning all the time isn't just a habit, it's attention to detail, it's something inside. And I think I saw last night something that I saw when I watched you play. I mean that, like that, it doesn't come easy to be at your best, to fight complacency, to fight rust. Keeping winning is not solely about ability.
Yeah, it's a mentality thing as well. And you know, at the age of 13, 14, there was a few of the guys in the boys' club, which I played at, were getting signed up on S-forums. At that time, they were called S-forums. Now you get youth academies and stuff. But it was S-forums, and I think these guys are all getting clubs ahead of me. But it never broke my spirit. And I said, I'm going to keep going every week, keep playing football, play as many games as I can, learn the game. I think you learn most by playing. I met with Zola a few weeks ago in the Middle East, and he said that it was just played all the time and horrible pitches, and that's where he learned all his skills. But, you know, for me, I kept going, and then I took a stretch between 15 and 17, 3 or 4 inches, and all of a sudden, I was getting offers left, right and centre. And it's that, you know, never give up, never say die.
So where's that from?
Well, I think that came, you know, we talk about role models. I think, you know, my mother and father were great role models. My dad was the guy who drove me, moaning all the time. I used to, after a game, sometimes fall out with him and I'd be walking 500 yards ahead of him up the road, and I'd walk in, my mother was waiting for me. Well, did you win, son? And I says, bloody him, you know. And she'd say, are you shouting at the wind again, you know.
why would he have done it now, looking back?
But let me qualify what that actually did for me was when she had given me my sandwiches, you know, the bacon and egg sandwiches for my lunch. I'm sitting there and I was actually thinking about what he was saying, and I'm saying he's right. He's absolutely right, because of the things he was saying were pretty constructive, you know. It wasn't just moaning at me for the sake of moaning, but we always had that competitive spirit.
Give us an example then. What might he say about you? Let's say either in a game where you know you've maybe not, for one reason or another, played your best, or you think you've played really well and you've won, but he's still got something to pick at. What might he have been saying to you?
It was small detail, you know, streetwise stuff. You know, for instance, you know, when you see a game now and a ball bounces before the centre-half should actually go for it, a simple thing like, don't let the ball bounce, son, you know, and go and meet the ball, you know, that stuff like that. And it all... When you learn that at a very young age, it stays with you forever.
Because crime and the gang violence was so bad, the police couldn't intervene anymore, and the government tried but couldn't, because, yeah, the gangs was just out of hand. It's like people live two streets from each other, and then they rival gangs, and they would shoot, like, literally from that window, that window building there, they would just shoot at each other, and people walking past or people like maybe in their houses, they don't care if you get hit. It's a drive-by. That was everyday life for me. Wow. You know? And then the community, I think the community came together and to try and fight this thing as well. That's like, nah, like, too many innocent kids and people are dying because of these stupid guys.
Then what people around you, people that you grew up with, people in your school?
One of my best friends, guy that every single day we were together, we were playing football outside my house. And then obviously because halftime and then we have a break, so whichever house is the closest, you go and get the water and the glasses. So the wall of my house was the goalpost. So I'm the closest, so I went in to go and grab, bring the water and you know, the halftime snacks or whatever we had, crisps or that. And we were all just sitting and talking about the first half, so I went in. And about literally, I was in the house for like 30, not even 30 seconds. 10 seconds from me leaving the group. And we were like 11 years old. Go in the house and then just heard, pa, 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 gunshots. And coming towards here, and I just saw. And I was like, holy man. So I ran outside. But this is the level that we're at. When you hear gunshots, you go and run for cover, and that we run to see where it comes, where it's coming from. So that was just how it was. So I went outside, and obviously the guys, they were all, normally we lie on the floor flat because it's very difficult that it could catch you where they shoot down because it's normally up. So everybody was just lying flat and that, and then eventually we looked through the flats. And we saw the rival gang guys ran back to where they're from, like across the football pitch. And then so then, yeah, we all like, hey, everybody okay? And Reginald, he just kept laying there. And as we're like, hey, Mo, Reg, lifted him up. Brains spattered everywhere. Oh. That was the closest I came. We were 11 years old, and wow.
So an 11-year-old Reginald is just an innocent victim of a gang shooting in the general direction of another gang, and they kill Reginald.
Yeah, kids playing, and they said they think we are rival gangs. So. And yeah, he got his head taken off. And
now, how do you live like that? What do you do mentally and physically to cope with that?
The quicker I can get myself out of here, the better.
The old thing like boxing used to be the way out of a ghetto. Do you realise at this stage that football's your way out? Or is that being too romantic?
No, that's too romantic. I was good at it, better than most kids in my area. But yeah, South Africa's got like 50 million people. I'm sure I'm not better than 50 million people. So there's more talent, way better players than me out there. So chances of me making it is 1 to 1 billion, probably. That was, you know, the understanding. But so hit the books and just hope, you know, you keep on playing football, to stay off the streets and give yourself like a life expand.
Why not join them?
Because my dad would, I would die by my dad's hand. He would beat my ass. He would beat us up so hard. So we would die that way than die in a gang. So it was either one. So I'd rather take my chances with being home and go to school and try and make it another way than to join a gang where my dad would kill me anyway.
Did that make you unusual?
Yes.
Did people pick on you because you didn't want to?
Yeah, I was a wimp. I was everything you can think of. Ah, leave that wimp. You know, you let him go and play his football, and while they go and join and run around with guns or hiding guns for the gang, for the members when the police comes and stuff.
Well, scoring a final is scoring in a final. Well, scored in a final at the camp now is gorgeous.
Listen, mate, the main thing is that we won. I couldn't care less about
scoring. This lack of ego thing again.
No, but I couldn't care less about scoring goals and losing games. It means nothing to me. I scored 2 at Wembley and we won the but we won the trophy. That's all that matters. Winning and scoring in the final, it was my first year in Madrid. You know, it was sort of, people always questioned, why is he gone? Why has he left the Premier League? You know, and you sort of, Real Madrid were not on television every single week like they are now. So you sort of, you are gone, you've gone, you know, so people don't know what you're doing. They just have snippets now and again, or that, oh yeah, and next minute you've won 3-0 in the final. And everybody's like, ah, that's why he's that's why he left. Because, of course, it was really hard for me to leave Liverpool. And, you know, people didn't like the fact that I left Liverpool and I left on a free. And
well, it was jealousy or anger?
Well, I think so. Jealous, bit of anger. I mean, I always found it fine within Liverpool, but, you know, people always tried to make a big deal of it back then. But then a year later, or even 9 months later, people are like, ah, that's why he left. He's just won the Champions League. And it was my first year of ever playing in the Champions League and playing against the best players in the world. So to score, to win, I score and turn and run over to where my father is and all that. And, you know, 9 months prior, he's just lost his son, as in me, to go to a foreign country. He's just lost his wife. So my dad's there with like 19 or 17, 18, 19 of my mates' family. So I ran over to them and sort of celebrated, and I saw them later on. You know, that's what it's all about.
These are for you. If you have enjoyed it, then there's a treasure trove of more than 40 of those types of interviews with, for example, Michael Carrick, Gianluca Vialli, Graham Souness, not to mention Harry Redknapp, Gaizka Mendieta, Ramon Calderon. They're all there because people seem excited to talk in this style about the sport we love, and then about their lives and their laughs and their loves and their mistakes. And look, you get the picture. If you want to go and listen to more of these, if you want to subscribe and support our podcast, which is vital to us, then go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter, and it'll be the best forward slash you've ever had.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.